Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Scales of Truth. I'm Tyson Harley. Today, I want to touch on the aspect of a culture war historical point that's about to happen. So we're going to have a couple of different aspects to this. I'm going to explain for background this Roe v. Wade overturn and some things that people miss. And then I'm going to go into the idea of what this first culture war event thereafter, or at least major one thereafter the overturn, the Sunflower States vote on an amendment that about abortion. So Sunflower State, I'm an expert on, and in the Sunflower State, that's Kansas, we have an amendment and placards are up everywhere. Kansans for constitutional freedom say vote no. And so what does all that mean? And are people fibbing? Whenever you have a cultural war battle, you can basically assume that people are being sloppy with their facts and or lying through their teeth. So going to get to that, and then I'm going to promise you a follow-up podcast because I do want to look into one other little aspect that could possibly tip my opinion on this. All right, so for background, remember, I've graduated law school and a political science minor, and I don't want your... Don't worry, this decision won't be based on, this analysis won't be based on my little amount of education. I'm going to back this up. I want to give you a little bit of background just as points of interest of, you know, being somewhat interested in American history growing up and then, being a high school graduate, basically being a decent student, paid attention to American history and the idea of balance of powers. And, you know, even if you will, go back to Schoolhouse Rock and what the role of each branch was. And then, going into graduate school after attending the service, being in the service, I was interested in both political science and then wanting to be in communications about it, you know, like a mass communications type of a situation. And picked broadcasting, but had political science as my minor. Picked some American history type courses at that time. And then, of course, in law school. So in law school, after with all that background, we then, you know, got a better emphasis yet on what the court intends to do, the Supreme Court and just appellate courts in general, when it comes to constitutional law and how it behaves around laws. And the quick answer to that is they say that they don't legislate. So what they do is they look at a law and decide whether it's constitutional or not. They do not legislate. If the legislature then wants to create another law, they can definitely do that. If they want to amend their constitution based on the feedback of whatever law or otherwise, then they can do that. And what I mean by that last part is that the Supreme Court interprets the Constitution, but it doesn't mean that every single part of the Constitution is absolutely immovable. So through the will of the people or through the passing of state legislatures, you can add amendments to the Constitution, you can change it. And then what would have been a certain ruling by the Supreme Court might be different because they are looking at the Constitution. So after spending a year plus all the other background, then in constitutional law in the first year of law school, you find out that through any number of means, the Supreme Court tries to not be too active. It's a balance of powers thing. I actually think, and this is the funny thing, because you're going to say, oh, yeah, you call anybody who wants to be a progressive, you say the court is an activist court. And I say, nope, that's literally how they try to paint their task in the balance of powers, you know, three branch system. They do not want to become a super legislature. That is, that's their mission. That's their words. They don't want to become a super legislature that legislates from the Supreme Court bench. They instead want to say whether or not a law is constitutional or not. And then the legislators, being closer to the people and elected thereby, can then decide based on the, you know, better clarification of what's constitutional or not, can create another law, a different law. And also then the Supreme Court will say, listen, if we can find a reason not to intervene, we will. So this is where I say often the court is not activist enough. They will have what's called standards of review by which, depending on the subject matter, they will say, let's mostly leave this alone if we can, by assuming a certain, giving them a certain benefit of the doubt. These are standards of review and how much they will review de novo. That's brand new. Will they look at the facts brand new? Basically, they will not at the Supreme Court level, at the appellate level. They will not reinterpret the facts. They can reinterpret the law, or rather they interpret the law, but even then there can be different standards of review for the lower court. So if the lower court said a certain thing, the Supreme Court doesn't necessarily want to just be overturning lower courts willy-nilly. And so these types of things, and then specifically they will give some benefits of doubt to the legislators. And for instance, if there is some rational basis for a law, even if de novo, they may have, that's brand new, looking from the ground up as though it had not gone through the courts, or looking at it as just a straight constitutional issue, they may have said this is unconstitutional. Now listen to me, even if just looking at it as a straight academic constitutional issue, academically, they would have said this is unconstitutional, they will limit themselves and say, well, but the legislators have to be given some benefit of doubt, and or the lower court has to be given some benefit of doubt. And therefore, we will not look at it brand new. We will, was there any rational basis for why that law was created? These types of things, or maybe a rational basis as to why an executive order was made. Again, another mistake, because many things, the executive order aspect of the presidential powers have gone through the roof. So knowing all these limits, I then read constitutional law cases and see Roe v. Wade and say, and that's entirely different than everything they just said. Now, I now want to say, if you don't believe me, we have Casey, which was Roe v. Wade's next major Supreme Court case in 1992, that basically said the very thing. They said, wow, they acted far different than the Supreme Court usually acts. However, because we want to give benefit of doubt to the Supreme Court itself, so see another, you know, when they don't, remember, they don't have to even review a case. So that's part of the leaving the actions of other branches alone. And then in this case, there's something called stare decisis, which means basically leave it alone for precedential law. That is law that's the Supreme Court, and I think it may apply to lower courts. I forget if at least the idea applies to it. But certainly it definitely also applies to the Supreme Court. If it has already been decided, we're gonna assume it is valid and leave it alone for the most part. Now that might be, and I can't tell you whether technically when you just don't pick up the case, that's considered. I don't think so, that it's considered stare decisis. But certainly They can also say, listen, we're going to mostly leave it alone. The Supreme Court has looked at this. So in the Casey case that the Supreme Court took up, they said, yeah, it was really an unusual decision, was Roe, but we are going to mostly leave it alone. However, we do find the trimester plan set up by Roe to be a little odd, so we're going to go with undue burden. Now, why did both Casey and me and others say that Roe was more than a little odd? Because they did indeed legislate specifically. They didn't merely remand. That means, you know, it goes back to a lower court to consider this law as is, the trial court, or rather than letting the legislators, just telling them it's unconstitutional, and then therefore it struck, and now the legislators must come up with a better law if they want one. Otherwise, they don't have that particular law. Rather than that, they came up with a trimester system where the balance of viability was a major factor, a part of their decision. So they said trimesters and viability. And the viability aspect was an interesting framework. So they're not supposed to come up with framework that would make a proper law. They're supposed to say, and definitely not specifics. And instead, they were legislative and said, hey, we're going to break this up. They're not supposed to be the finders of fact or the creators of framework that would be around that would help establish fact. But they created a trimester situation where that they said, okay, here, instead of saying, here's where the balance lies, pre-viability of the baby, then abortions can be unlimited. After that, you have to weigh the competing interests of society, which once the baby is viable, now you do have a potential interest in the, or rather a state, a societal interest in the life, the potential life of the baby. So then you go, at what point is it reasonable for states to decide to limit abortion? So that was a big, important part of Roe that some people don't realize. It's like, no, absolutely, you can restrict abortion. But here's the trimester aspect. Here's the viability aspect. Yes, potential life is an important consideration. And so this viability piece in the trimester aspect. Once potential life is a part of the equation, things change. So the only thing Roe v. Wade really did was keep abortion from being entirely prohibited, which may or may not be a major step, but I'm just trying to clarify. I mean, many may say yes, and that's a good thing. It shouldn't be entirely prohibited. And so you had Casey saying, oh, we're going to leave this alone. However, then we will also realize and admit that Roe was an odd decision, but we're not going to overturn it, but yet they do. They replace it with a standard called undue burden. If there is an undue burden on the abortion, then it's not allowed. But the problem with the undue burden standard, which Dobbs pointed out, and then even the state amendment that I'm going to bring up points out, is that the undue burden, it was hard. It didn't provide any certainty. So they replaced a trimester situation with instead undue burden, with maybe the idea that they were trying to clarify and clear up things, or maybe that they weren't quite trying to be so activist. You know, to assume that 3 months and 6 months is the exact right thing, since they are not the finders of fact, of, you know, when the quickening or when viability happens. And this, again, is the Roe problem. It's like, so you are now the arbiter of fact, and you have decided the viability is at, you know, 6 months or third trimester. I'm not exactly sure how they measured that. I think it was probably three and six was the dividing lines, but I'm not totally sure on that. And so Casey said no. Instead, it's undue burden, which in a way was a little bit of a good correction because, as I say, you're not the arbiter of fact. Whereas the three and the six, that's for the state legislators to come up with upon review of fact and then to see if it passes, you know, upon their various different strategies. But the problem is that the undue burden standard did not provide any kind of certainty. And thus we got to the wide variance in abortion laws anyway that were two. And so both Dobbs, which overturned Roe v. Wade, and then the Kansas Supreme Court decision that's the basis of the amendment I'm going to talk to you about, which was, if you will, a pro-abortion, considered a pro-abortion case, both said the undue burden aspect is wildly uncertain. Now, the other thing about Dobbs is that really, as a libertarian, all it one could analyze it as, and anybody could analyze it as, but and that's the way they stated it. The Dobbs decision, which overturned Roe v. Wade, said, listen, this is very specific. Okay, this is only having to do with Casey and with Roe v. Wade and with abortion. And the reason, part of the reason, you know, if you want to say, yeah, but they're just saying that doesn't mean it can't apply. Well, the reason it can apply that way is A, people do look at Supreme Court cases to see exactly the wording that the judges, you know, used for intent and going forward. But then also because Dobbs pointed out another distinction that probably Casey did too. And that is that in bringing up the penumbra of privacy, and so I've discussed penumbra of privacy, my concerns were if Roe v. Wade gets overturned, what about the vaccine, you know, right to your own body choices aspect? I was worried about that, said, well, this is interesting timing. And I can tell you that after reading the case, I mean, outside of purely philosophically, and then somebody brings up a separate case, the Dobbs decision has nothing to do with the ability or inability to get a vaccine. It would be at best some analogy. And the reason I say that is because Dobbs points out that for the penumbra of privacy type cases, the right to your own bodily integrity, this type of thing, what Roe v. Wade brought up was no cases wherein the competing interest of another life was involved. Literally, this competing interest of a potential life of a baby versus the health of the mother or otherwise was not brought in. It was never any of the precedential case law. So that's why I say that the Dobbs thing really has nothing to do with the vaccine deal, except purely as a rough and approximate analogy that somebody else could argue. In a legal sense, it does not. They say the precedential law of Roe v. Wade, while acting like that was directly applicable, did not have any of the competing interest of something like another life. Further, Dobbs points out that, and we're going to find an analogy in the Kansas statute and Kansas situation, that in looking at the laws when the 14th Amendment was passed, because the 14th Amendment ended up being some large part of the Roe decision that helped connect these abortion rights to, you know, to the rest of the Constitution. The 14th Amendment passed after the Civil War, and I can't remember, 1867 or something like that. May have been 1865, right when the war ended, but I don't think so. Anyway, in looking at the 14th Amendment, Roe ignored the actual state of the laws in the United States. And so Dobbs argues this is the case that overturned Roe v. Wade, that Roe v. Wade misstated wildly the state of abortion laws in the United States in 1867, or whenever the 14th Amendment passed. And if you look at the state of the abortion laws, and that is that there were plenty of restrictive laws, including many criminalization of abortion laws, then how is it that the 14th Amendment is a deciding factor in bringing in the right to abortion? And so that, again, is another thing that separates it from the mere privacy right, the general, if you will, vaccine right, the right to bodily integrity. So Dobbs then, going back to what I was saying, really brings back these rights back to the people through the exercise of their laws at the state level. It is taking away the idea that the Supreme Court gets to make creative arguments to overturn existing laws, like really creative arguments, like ignoring the fact that there were plenty of abortion laws. Now, one can always argue, well, shoot, when the tone of the state changes, then the tone of the state law can change. When the tone, the political viewpoints of the citizens change, then the state law can change. And that's what Dobbs would argue and does argue. We are not to stand in place of the legislature, just the thing I told you to begin with. And that means the U.S. Congress or the various states' Congress. All right, now to the Kansas Amendment at hand. And the Kansas Amendment, I am going to do a follow-up, but I'm running out of time here. Got to get on to my regular professional life. I'll do a follow-up tonight. And the vote is tomorrow. So if I find anything different, I have now looked into the Supreme Court case, and I will explain that. At this moment, I can tell you that I am probably voting yes. So the analogy here is very great. There was a 2019 Kansas Supreme Court law that found for the first time in the history of Kansas a fundamental right to abortion. And in a very, now that I've looked through the Kansas Supreme Court case, I can tell you the analogy is great. They pulled it from whole cloth. In reality, the dissenting opinion is the correct one. And they did this in order to overturn, did the Kansas Supreme Court, a passed by the legislature, the Kansas legislature, law that would stop dilation and extraction. That's a euphemism for them. Abortions in Kansas in the second trimester and beyond. Now, dilation is an extraction is that first you must induce labor. So right there, it takes away from a lot of the emergency aspect, but we're not going to argue that now. There is some argument, but remember, you have to induce the labor to do dilation and extraction, which is pulling a baby limb from limb. So the state Supreme Court found that because Kansas's constitution had a fundamental right in abortion, that law couldn't pass. Now, even though they found a fundamental right to abortion, somehow they still had to, you know, leave the, you know, if once viability happens, is there is an interest. There is an interest that the state has, but yet they were overly legislative in some way because the legislature was the ones interpreting that interest. And it seemed reasonable. But the Supreme Court case said that, well, but this is the procedure by which most abortions are done. Well, yes, because it's legal. That doesn't mean there can't be other procedures or that there couldn't be birth. But they brought up other procedures that could happen. The Supreme Court was not impressed, saying the safety of those procedures have not been established. But again, the big aspect here, procedurally, is that after finding the fundamental right to abortion, the Kansas Supreme Court therefore remanded this case back down to the original trial court. Presumably, the trial court, and that's one thing maybe I'll add in my upcoming podcast, did strike this statute down. But regardless, then, what is one of the answers to a Supreme Court saying, you know, finding something because of vagueness of a state constitution? Well, the answer can be get rid of the vagueness of the state constitution. And I can tell you inherently, the state Supreme Court basically found it in the life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness language. Nothing more specific than that. And in fact, then the state Supreme Court said, while they waived the, you know, bowed to the idea of understanding the original intent, they also, and they were looking only at the Kansas Constitution. They said, we don't have to bring in the U.S. Constitution. Because after all, the U.S. Constitution and Roe v. Wade relies heavily on the 14th Amendment. So we're going to only look to the Kansas Constitution because the Kansas Constitution preceded the 14th Amendment by something like 8 years, 9 years. And so we don't need to look at the 14th Amendment. But yet then they brought in a lot of the 14th Amendment reasoning. And touched on a lot of Supreme Court cases that relied on the 14th Amendment, state and federal. But after, you know, saying we will consider the, we must original, consider the words and the intent of the Kansas Constitution. In so doing, they looked back at the constitutional conventions, which I think it was a great case study in the constitutional conventions and the general natural rights, which is an important part of a true republic, is to understand there are natural rights and the government does not take away from those natural rights. It merely helps enforce them. And it also doesn't require an enumeration, a listing of those rights that humans have. That part was very good, actually. But then in saying, well, when we look at whether or not the intent was to include abortion, we will look at life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And then after they looked at that, they pointed out the fact that Kansas law at the time as a territory and then afterwards as a state included abortion restrictions. But they said, we don't find that persuasive as to what the intent was at the time, and they find a garbage logic. They use garbage logic to come up with this because no case law, no basic and proper case law says that in order to understand the intent, you look at the laws at the time and then you say, bah, but they probably didn't really reflect the will of the people. But that's what the Kansas Supreme Court does. They probably didn't really reflect the will of the people. But just like Roe v. Wade and Dobbs overturning it, the Supreme Court case in 2019, while talking to try to get to the right of abortion, really the final decision there is only about abortion. And similarly, and so I'm against creative arguments where they mistake the original intent, no matter even if it's to good effect, if they mistake the original intent, then I'm against those arguments. So I will be voting yes on Amendment 2. And the reason I'll be voting yes on Amendment 2 comfortably is that Amendment 2, which is the amendment at up for vote on August 2nd, in the state of Kansas, specifically says abortion. The name of the amendment is abortion, and it And it is listed in the summary very, very narrowly, the summary that must be included when you have an amendment. And it is listed in the amendment itself. It's very narrow. It is abortion. And paraphrase, I'll do this in the follow-up podcast. It says, as to abortion, the people, through their legislators, can make laws thereupon. And so, and therefore, the Supreme Court case no longer stands. I think it says that expressly. But they throw a bone towards life of mother, but that really means, or you didn't have to say that. You didn't have to say that. They threw a bone to the decision that, you know, the pro-abortion that said, hey, there are exceptions, and the legislators, it would already be the case that they would have to take them into account. But they say, hey, including like rape and incest and life of the mother. Now, that is put there literally to cover the aspect that the law says, you know, exceptions to the life of the mother. That's an important part of the case law, an important distinction as to whether something is more acceptable or not. That is why they put those in there. It's very narrow and very specific. It merely says the Congress of Kansas, that is the legislature, through the House and the Senate, can make laws regarding abortion. But the argument in all of the commercials, because when I say this is a culture war touch point, it is. It's one of the first things after the Roe v. Wade overturn. The commercials are absolutely deceptive. They have people saying, I had the right to consider my life when my life was at risk. And if this is passed, other people won't have that same right. And I think maybe they've adjusted to say, may not have the this right. But that's not true. It's that they definitely still have the right. The real thing that they're skipping over is it is possible then that Kansas legislators could pass laws that would not allow that right. But honestly, that wouldn't pass constitutional scrutiny to this point. So the amendment is very, very narrow. We will cover some of that amendment later on, and I might touch a little bit more on the Kansas constitutional, the Supreme Court case. I will be voting yes on the amendment because while the Kansans for Constitutional Freedom say that it's not fair that now the right of the people, the will of the people can be overturned by the legislatures, they miss the point that both cases were activist cases where instead of the directly elected legislators, the courts actually interpreted the amendment and limited the laws. But because they think in their mind that they were expanded, they think it's okay. I go back to the super legislature idea that, you know, the courts acted as a super legislature that decided in substitution for the legislators what the law means. And now the legislators are trying to take back that power. And in a way, that the funny thing very quickly is that this Supreme Court case in 2019 didn't take away all abortion restrictions. So one could argue, why do you need the amendment? Well, I'm going to vote yes on the amendment because I don't believe that Alice in Wonderland stuff where you say, yes, we will definitely, we have to look at what the Constitution meant. And in so doing, we have to look at the state of the law, the state of things at the time. And in so doing, we find that the state of things, including laws that restricted abortion, but we don't find those persuasive. I don't believe in that kind of creative, purposeful impossibility in logic. So I will be voting yes for Amendment 2. I'll do a follow-up to do any final kind of touch bases on this, but there you are for a Kansas Amendment 2, which is up for vote tomorrow, August 2nd. It will be a big culture war touch point after the Dobbs decision. And I think, unfortunately, it will be voted down. The amendment will not be passed. I don't believe it will be, but that is why I'm voting yes. It is very narrow, and it takes away from the Supreme Court this idea that no matter what it said, it really does just take away original intent. And original intent is the life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And therefore, I would be worried that no longer does the true original intent really the basis. And if it's not the basis, then the Constitution just swings in the wind based on what Supreme Court justices decide, regardless of what state legislators decide. And I can guarantee you that state court legislatures are more likely to uphold basic rights than is the Supreme Court. Because I just told you that they tend to defer when things become unconstitutional, such that then they're still considered constitutional because they want to defer when they want to legislators and to other courts and to executive powers. So this idea that they should be trusted to not only defer there, but also find more rights. Well, you tell me how the last 2.5 years have gone as far as whether they found, quote, more rights. I don't think so. It's not good. We can't be having a flexible document that the Supreme Court case can overrule the logic of the original intent, which was incredibly wide, of both the U.S. Constitution and of the state legislators. As Kansas Supreme Court points out, one of the great things that many of the state legislatures did was include the Declaration of Independence, Life, Liberty, and Pursuit of Happiness language, which is and the phrase natural rights, incredibly important. While the Declaration of Independence included that in the United States, the Constitution itself did not. And so the state legislators' language is, and the state constitution's language is much broader. But if the Supreme Court can then decide what things mean out of whole cloth with absolute Alice in Wonderland, quote, logic or lack thereof, such that, oh yeah, we know laws existed at the time, but it doesn't overturn the idea that this was a fundamental right, even though we had laws against it at the time. So that's where I stand with Amendment 2, and there's your Dobbs and Roe v. Wade and Casey analysis, and even the Kansas Supreme Court analysis from 2019. Thanks for listening. I'm Tyson Harley.